So this morning, we're going to continue on in our message series on the Sermon on the Mount. And as we begin this week, we're going to consider a place geographically that is both far from here and is really also far from where the Sermon on the Mount was spoken. It's closer, but it's far. We're going to start off by thinking about the city of Rome. And I don't do this often where I ask for participation during messages, but if you have been to the city of Rome, would you raise your hands? Do we have anyone? Okay, we haven't. Well, neither have I. But one time I did watch the movie Gladiator, and I was entertained by the movie, and so I feel like I kind of feel like I've been there and experienced it at least a little bit. But if you would go not to the depiction of Rome that Russell Crowe offered to us in Gladiator, if you would go to Rome now, there's one thing that kind of dominates the sort of the skyline. It's not necessarily much of a skyline, but kind of the cityscape of Rome, and it is the cross. If you look over the city of Rome, one symbol that you see over and over and over again is the cross. It's on all kinds of different cathedrals that are through the city. It's something that is just prevalent all throughout Rome. And it's kind of crazy the way that the cross has taken prevalence over the landscape in Rome, over the cityscape. Because if we consider our passage, if we consider the Sermon on the Mount, if Jesus had said to people in that time that, hey, the teachings that I'm laying out for you today, they are going to become the dominant religion in the Roman Empire. They're going to become the dominant religion that's practiced throughout kind of the known world. People would have thought, what? We're not even really sure what you're talking about. But what we know is that, as we looked at the Beatitudes last week, what we know is that you just talked about being meek and merciful and persecuted and poor in spirit. And none of those things seem to align with Rome. If you said that just a few short years or generations afterwards, that all of the sudden the Roman Empire would have been transformed, it would have sounded crazy to the people who were there. Rome was a city that was powerful and was very religious. At that point, when Jesus spoke the Sermon on the Mount, Rome had already existed for 1,000 years. And the kind of the story behind the founding of Rome was that it was the two sons of the god Mars that sort of established the city. There were temples built to Jupiter that were present in the city, temples built to the other Roman gods. It was a place that was actively full of worship, not to Jesus, not to God. And it was not just that he was not worshipped there. It was that the Roman government oppressed the people that Jesus would have been speaking to. He was speaking to people who had been conquered. He was speaking to people who had their land taken away from him. People who had had a fortress built to observe the way that they were worshipping in their temple. There are people who felt disrespected by Rome. And yet, eventually, the symbol of Christianity would come to dominate over that city. If you said that to Jesus' followers right after his crucifixion, even after his crucifixion and resurrection, they'd be hard-pressed to believe that. Hard-pressed to believe that Pontius Pilate, the Roman authority and governor, who had consented and given permission, kind of in collusion with the Jews, to sentence Jesus to death, to say, hey, Rome is not a fan of you, Jesus. I don't think that your symbol is going to reign over that city. It would have sounded ridiculous to them at that time. If you imagine saying to the first century church that the cross would kind of be the prominent symbol over top of Rome, it would have been laughable. We're well aware of the fire. History would make us well aware of the fire that broke out in Rome in 64 AD, just some 30 years after Jesus' time, when the church is still this small kind of fledgling movement, growing, but small, especially small in comparison to the other religions around them. And 30 years into the religion, a fire breaks out in Rome. Nero allows the fire to burn for a while before doing anything about it. And then he sets Christians to blame for the fire that's taken place. And the stories that historians tell about that period are disgusting and disturbing. There was a place called Nero's Circus, and it was not what we imagine with elephants standing on small balls or people jumping into pools of water. It was this kind of this area where Christians were tortured. Church history would tell us that's where the Apostle Peter, where his life ended, was in Nero's circuses. This was a time when there was a bounty placed on the head of Christians. When Christians came into Rome so that they could be taken directly to the Colosseum to be either to be forced to killing each other or to be eaten by animals. It was a terrible period for Christians. And if you said to them, in 64 AD, that in 250 years, the religion of Rome would be Christianity, it would have seemed crazy. But it was 300 AD, right around that time, just 250 years later, that Constantine establishes Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. In less than three centuries, the Christian religion went from the Colosseum to the castle, to the emperor, to the most powerful positions in the world. We see this transition that takes place. And if you were sitting there and you were talking to these people, people that Jesus spoke to at the Sermon on the Mount, or some of those early Christians, even 100 years after Jesus, and you said someday Christianity will be the dominant religion in the Roman Empire, they would say, how on earth is that going to happen? How will we go from people who are being fed to lions to people who are accepted in this kind of a society? And I'll say this, it wouldn't have happened because Christians were really, really good people that followed all of the laws. It wouldn't have happened because Christians knew that they were right and everyone else was wrong, and they reminded them of that regularly. It wouldn't have happened because Christians were the smartest or the coolest or had the best teachers that could answer any objection. They had great teachers who answered lots of objections, but they weren't necessarily the smartest people that were around. It didn't happen because of those things. It happened because the people who were the first followers of Christ took very seriously the words that Jesus spoke to them about the role that they were supposed to play in the world. The gospel spread because people were changed by Jesus, by the teachings of Jesus, by the identity that Jesus spoke over his followers, and because they chose to be faithful to that picture and to live that out and to follow that. And when they did that, it changed the world. And part of that teaching that is so clear and significant is what we find in the Sermon on the Mount. So this morning, we're going to look at two ways that Jesus speaks identity over his followers. Two ways that Jesus recognizes how his followers are supposed to live. And we're going to start by reading in Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. It says this, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." So the first piece is this, that Jesus tells us that we, that his followers, that people who believe in him are the salt of the earth. And you probably have heard this before, but it's good to ask the question, what does Jesus mean by the salt of the earth? And there are two basic ways that we use salt in our culture here and today, and one is to flavor our food, and the other is to get the ice off of our roads. But as Jesus speaks about what it means to be the salt of the earth, he's talking about this act of salt as preservation. This act of salt that at the time, in the days before refrigeration, that salt was the method that people allowed their food to have a longer shelf life, a way that they were able to transport things, a way that people were able to store things without having it go bad. It would be kind of like if you were looking at the passage today, it would be almost as if Jesus says to them, you are the refrigerators of the earth. And the truth is this, kind of the inference of what Jesus is saying is that where there's the absence of salt, there is the presence of decay, the presence of rot. When there is no refrigerator, your food rots. When your freezer trips and goes bad, people scramble to either cook food or to give it away to people before it rots. When things like that happen, there's rot in the absence of something to preserve it. And so Jesus tells his audience that their role, that the role of his followers is to preserve the earth. He doesn't talk about food with them. He says, you are the salt of the earth. Jesus is saying that followers of Christ were supposed to be people that keep the earth from rotting. Followers of Christ are to be the kind of people that preserve politics from rotting. Followers of Christ are to be the people that preserve our families from rotting, our communities from rotting, our sense, even the establishments that we have in regards to work, to keep the workplace from rotting, to keep finances and the culture surrounding finances from rotting, to keep our art and the discussions that we have from rotting. Jesus says to the people, you are the salt of the earth that you live in. Your responsibility in the earth is to preserve it from decay, to preserve it from rotting. And the first century church grabbed on to this notion from Jesus, and they took it seriously, that their role as followers of Christ was to preserve the world from decay. And we don't think about this very often in our culture. We don't acknowledge it very often, but we benefit from this worldview and from this view of life every single day. Much of what we assume is common human decency is not common to us. Much of what we assume is common human decency in the way that we treat each other, in the way that we view each other, in the way that we act towards one another, is not just something that's instilled in us by nature. It's something that has been instilled in our culture and in much of Western society through the core kind of foundations and beliefs of Christianity, of the Judeo-Christian faith, that people are made in the image of God, and as a result, they deserve equal treatment. As a result, they are valuable. As a result, they carry an intrinsic sense of value in them. Things that we uphold and look to as a culture, people who are gracious and generous with one another, those aren't things that are necessarily built into our nature, but those are things that have kind of been shaped into our culture because people were faithful to the way of life that Jesus called them to live in. Much of what we experience and just think of as decency are things that you look back to the church taking seriously its role to preserve the earth from decay. And Jesus doesn't stop about preserving the earth from decay. He goes on to say that we are also the light of the world. And so in the same way that salt prevents rot, light prevents darkness. And so light gives us direction. Light gives us clarity on what we're seeing. Jesus is saying that this is a world of darkness that we live in, and that his followers are supposed to be light. And he doesn't speak about this again as an action, but as an identity. He doesn't say you are to act as light. He says you are to be light. In verse 14 it says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. So there's this impression that we get from Jesus that when a light is set, that when we are being faithful in following him, that we are supposed to carry that sense of light with us wherever we go in life. And it doesn't just kind of say to wander throughout life setting this light. It explains that where we are in life is a place where we have been set. The idea of being built on a hill, like some of your translations might say, or being set on a hill, is something that's important for us to consider. Because in those days, the idea of being placed, a city being placed on a hill, was something that was used for kind of protection or used to gain strategic advantage. But it means that it isn't something that was just kind of placed there willy-nilly, like people were wandering through the desert or wandering through the land and thought, this seems good. We'll build a city here. It was something that was chosen, a location with intention, where people decided to build cities and to set themselves. And in the same way, Jesus says, even though sometimes in life we might feel like we're kind of floating by, or we're meandering, or we're not sure why we're in the job that we're in, or why we're in the location that we're in, or fill in the blank about why we might kind of feel like we're floating in life, Jesus says that his followers are a city on a hill who have been set in a position to be light for the world that's around them. And then in verses 15 and 16, he kind of elaborates on what it means to be this light. He says, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. This is a powerful statement that Jesus delivers. We're going to read verse 16 again. It says, in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they, the world who are not followers of Christ, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. There are places in Scripture that talk about how people will know that we're Christians, by the love that we have for each other. There are places in Scripture that talk about, that give clear instructions on the way that we are supposed to live. And some of those things might indicate to people that we are Christians. But if we think about it, how do most people know that we're Christians today? Probably because we go to church. If we're friends with them, or if we have some kind of relationship with them, we might have talked about our faith with them at some point. If we go to a restaurant dressed nicely on Sunday afternoon, a waiter or waitress might assume that you're a Christian. You know, if we think about it, what is it really that distinguishes us from any other group of people that we might encounter? And in this passage, Jesus makes it clear in verse 16 that people should be able to look at the way that we live our lives and know that there is something that is different about us. And this is the crazy thing. Not just know that there is something different about us, but they should be able to look at the way that we live and then give glory, begin to praise God because of our actions. This statement is powerful. People should be able to see and observe how kind we are to others. People should be able to see how joyful we are, a joy that's kind of deep in us, that exceeds and that supersedes the circumstances that we experience in life when we go through things that are mundane or unenjoyable. People should see the way that we're able to respond with difficult circumstances with peace and hope. People should see how gracious Christians are, even when others don't deserve it. People should be able to look at us and see the way that we care for the poor and the weak and the underprivileged and the marginalized in society. People should be able to see the way that the church, the body of Christ, invests in our community in ways that we don't hope to gain anything or receive anything in return from that investment. People should be able to see the way that we seek the peace and prosperity of those who are around us. People should be able to get a sense from us that we genuinely care about them. Our neighbors should be people that understand that we care about them through the actions that we take, through the words that we share with them, through the ways that we offer help to them when they're in need, whether that's with something small or something significant. Just through the way that we give a kind wave to them as we're leaving for work in the morning. People should be able to see our lives and know that we live in such a way, and they might say, I don't know about the whole religion kind of thing. I'm not sure about Christianity. I don't understand everything that there is to that. But there is clearly something different about this person because of the way that they live in comparison with the rest of the world. People should see our actions in this life, and it should point them to God. And not just point them to God in a general kind of sense where they're able to say, why are you so nice? And you say, it's because I've been forgiven by Christ. That would be an incredible conversation and an opportunity that you would have. But it should be something where they would look at the way that we live in the world that we live in, and it would cause them to glorify God through those actions. It wasn't good preaching or teaching that brought adherence into the family of Christ. It was not that they, again, were the trendiest thing that was going on. I don't think anybody who was being tortured or fed to lions thought that their movement was the trendiest movement that was sweeping through the Roman Empire. It was the way that Christians cared for the poor and the orphans that eventually caused Romans to start laying down their malice towards them. It was the way that Christians stood with a hope in the face of persecution and stood with a determination in the face of imprisonment and certain death that eventually caused people to look at the way they lived their life and to realize that there was something different about them. The truth is that orphanages in Europe, they became a reality because people knew that Christians cared about others. And so when infants were unwanted, they were left on the steps of churches to find people who would care for their children. The reality is that Christians throughout time, like we talked about, have been the biggest champions for the rights of people and the equality of people. And as a result, the Christian values and morality have shaped not just culture, but have shaped laws and governments that have been established throughout much of the Western world. Christians have often been people through our history that have demonstrated that when other people are leaving a situation due to natural disaster or some kind of political turmoil, that instead of running out of a situation, we've run into those situations to provide care and comfort and spiritual guidance for people who are in places of struggling. This is the reason why the church has succeeded. If we look at an incredible example from our own kind of recent history, from the 1950s, there's a couple that some of you have probably heard the story of before. It's Jim Elliot and Elizabeth Howard. And this was a couple that growing up, Jim was the son of a pastor and Elizabeth was the daughter of missionaries. And at some point in their history, these people began to feel the call to missions work. And so they both, after they had graduated high school, they both ended up at Wheaton College studying missions. And Elizabeth specifically went to Wheaton College to study Greek because she felt this calling as a high school student that her role, her calling in life, was to go to people that did not have a copy of the Bible in their own language and to be able to translate the Bible for them into different languages. That's what she felt God had placed her on the earth to be able to do. So they both end up at Wheaton College, and then when they kind of part ways after Wheaton, and Elizabeth goes to a school in Canada to learn more about the process of being a missionary, and eventually Jim Elliot travels 18 days on boat from California to Quito, Ecuador, to begin this career and this life as a missionary. And this is in 1953 that he makes this journey. And so he's in Quito, Ecuador for a while, and he begins this process of learning the language of the people that he's with, and he excels kind of quickly. He's able to adapt to the culture and learn the language, and then he begins to minister to people who are present there. And he's ministering among the tribal people of Ecuador, not people who are in cities or things like that. And eventually, Elizabeth also ends up in Ecuador, and the couple are reunited and they get married in Quito, Ecuador. And they begin this life of reaching out to the tribal people in Ecuador together. And they're not alone, just the two of them. There's a team of missionaries who are present and reaching out to these tribal people. And so they do this for a while, for a few years. And at some point, Jim and Elizabeth, the Elliots, and a few other couples, they begin to learn about this tribe of Ecuadorian people called the Accas, which meant savage. And they begin to learn about how this is a tribe of people who are violent, not just to each other, but to outsiders as well. And they begin to kind of feel this burden because this group, they don't have the Bible that's been translated into their own language. They have never been reached with the gospel because they hurt people who are outsiders and are closed off from them. And so they begin to have this desire that burns inside of them to reach this group of people with the gospel. And so in reaching a people that are hard to reach, they sought to develop some goodwill with them. So there was a missionary pilot, and they would fly over areas where these tribal people were, and they would drop goods to them, kind of like very simple sort of goods to kind of begin the process of building goodwill towards them. And then eventually they learn just a few of the phrases in their language. And as they're flying over, dropping packages out of an airplane to them, they're using a PA system to kind of say to them that they're not trying to cause any harm to them, that they want to get to know them. And then on January 2nd in 1956, the five men from these missionary families, they decide they're going to make contact in person with the tribe. And so they find this location that's near the edge of the tribe. They get dropped off on a beach. It's a small plane, so they have to make several trips to just be able to get the five people there. And then once they land on the beach, the pilot flies around the jungle looking for areas where the tribe is and says to them that these missionaries are here and that they would like to talk with them. And then they just wait on the beach and nothing happens. And for days, they're shouting into the jungle, just trying to get to know the people who are there and to make contact with them. This is kind of, as we think about getting to know people or missions, this is kind of an incredible experience in and of itself. And incredible in the sense that it wasn't all that unique, the method that they were using to get in touch with these people. But they spend days yelling into the jungle, and I'm sure looking absurd. And then eventually, a small group of this tribe comes out to greet them. And there's one man there who is just kind of enamored with the presence of this small airplane. And so eventually, with a pilot, he begins to take him around, and they're flying over the jungle. And as they're going to villages, they're close enough that they can see the tribesmen. And so this guy is waving to people and things like that. And then at one point, they see a group of men that look like they're walking to the beach where the missionaries were located. And so they go back to the beach to get ready. And the pilot radios to his wife and says that they've made contact with people and it looks like they're going to have an opportunity to talk with them, and that he would call her later that day, kind of radio her to let her know how things went. And as the story goes on, he never has the opportunity to make that call. The group of men that showed up at the beach were warriors that came, and they came to kill the missionaries who were there. And there's stories of some misunderstanding that may take place in that process. But the long and short of it is that Jim Elliot and the team of missionaries are all killed and thrown into a river, and that the tribe, fearing retaliation with the way that they live violently, they go back to their village after they've kind of stripped everything they found of use. They go back to their village, they burn it to the ground, and they kind of flee deeper into the jungle so that they can't be found for anyone to take action against them. And it's fair to ask at this point, where is the salt and light that they provided in that situation? Does it seem senseless, the journey that they went on? And if the story ended there, it might feel that way. But this is what we know happens: that Elizabeth Elliot and the wife of the pilot, they stay in Ecuador. They stay there among the people ministering to them. And at the time, Jim and Elizabeth Elliot, they had a daughter who was 10 months old. So if you can imagine the position that they were in, she has a 10-month-old daughter. Her husband has been murdered by a violent tribe that they were trying to reach with the gospel. And she still remains with the conviction that God has called her to translate the Bible into languages that are unheard so that people can come to know him. So they stay in Ecuador. They minister among a tribe that they were already with and connected to, where the people are peaceful. And in that process, eventually two women leave the violent Aka tribe, and they find themselves in a relationship with Elizabeth Elliot. And at one point, she welcomes them into her home to live with her. So the people from the tribe who killed her husband now live with her for a period of time. And it's through that process that she begins to learn more about the language. She connects with them. She ministers with them. And as they prepare to go back to their tribe, they open up a means for communication for Elizabeth Elliot and Rachel Saint, another missionary, to be able to communicate with the Aka tribe. And at one point, these two women who have been widowed through this process actually go and live among the tribe and the people that killed their husbands, and they have the opportunity to share the gospel with them. And their testimony alone, the life that they lived and the words that they shared, changed that tribe. People began to come to know Christ. And as you look at the story now, over 60 years later, but still relatively short, it hasn't just changed the fact that some people in the tribe know Christ. It's changed the way that they live, the violence that they have. And so the numbers of the tribe have gone from a few hundred people, because they killed each other as well, to several thousand people that are involved in this tribe. Today, we know that the tribe has, 80% of the tribe has heard the gospel, and that 40%, almost half of the tribe, would say that they're Christians at this point in time. And they're not just people who have become recipients of the gospel and who have received the good word. This tribe of people, they are now sending missionaries out from them, to share the gospel with other people in different countries and among the different tribes that are surrounding them. So in 60 years, you see the impact that the gospel has had, because people were willing to live as salt and light in a world and in a situation that was rotten and dark, that was absent of any presence of light. You see the impact that the gospel was able to have in them. And it's that same kind of impact that happens throughout the Roman world. In 250 years, the city of Rome was drastically changed by Christians who followed the identity that Jesus spoke over them and lived as salt and light. In 60 years, the Aka tribe in Ecuador stopped killing each other and outsiders. Half of them became Christians, and they started sending missionaries out to share the gospel with other people. They took seriously the call to live, to embrace the identity of being people of salt and light. And we need to be people who follow in this kind of an example. We need to be people of salt and light in a world around us that is dying and dark. And one of the most important things about this passage that I've mentioned several times is that Jesus talks about this as an identity and not an action that we take. If being the salt of the earth, preserving the earth, is an action, then that means that the salt can sit safely and comfortably in the salt shaker until we decide to use it. And then we sprinkle a little bit out and we put the salt back in the shelf and we put it away until we choose to be the salt and to embrace in preserving the world around us. But Jesus doesn't tell us that. Jesus kind of explains to us that if salt loses its saltiness, if it loses its presence, it's not worth anything. He gives us an identity that we are to be salt and light in the world around us. And so for lots of us, myself included, it can be easy to make excuses as to why we might not be salt and light in the world around us. You know, there are lots of good reasons in a room like this, and I'm not pointing out anyone in particular. You could say, I have a job in government and I can't speak directly about Christianity. I have a job in a public school. I have a job where I mostly interact with patients who I have. I have a job X, Y, or Z where I don't have that freedom or opportunity to speak openly about the faith that I have. But the reality is that when Jesus talks about people being salt and light, he doesn't say that they should listen to the words that you say and should praise your God or your Father in heaven. He tells them that they should look at the way you live your life and that they should be able to praise your Father who is in heaven. That's a call for us to live in a way where people look at our lives and they see the work of God within us. Because the truth is that salt is no good in the salt shaker. It's no good if it's not doing anything, if it's just being stored. And that light, like the passage says and the kids song reminds us, that light is no good when it's hidden under a bushel. That it's not doing anything when it's there. And so as a result, it's not worth anything when it's there. It's not making anything more clear. It's not bringing hope into situations of darkness. And as people, we need to embrace the identity that Christ speaks over us to be salt and to be light. Because the reality is this, that we don't know the situation that people are in within our, sometimes within our own families, but certainly within our communities and our workplaces and people who are in spheres of influence. We don't understand the extent of the darkness that they experience at times, and we don't understand sometimes how close they are to a breakthrough of light and hope. We don't understand sometimes how ready people are to see a Christian life that points to God and to embrace a life of light and hope in the world that we have, where it's easy to dwell on the rotting and the darkness that we see all around us. And so this morning I want to ask us to consider what it would look like in our lives to be the preservatives of the earth. What it would look like in our lives to be light in a world that is dark, and to imagine how living as salt and light would change our families, our relationships, how it would change the culture and the society in which we live in. Lots of times we take a really hard view against our culture and our society, but I can say this, that in the time of Nero's Circus, it was significantly worse for Christians. Culture was significantly farther away from God, and it was in a culture like that that Christians made a decision to live faithfully as salt and light. And as a result, the world has been changed by Christ working through the church, by Spirit-empowered kingdom living.